This week, we finally come to the Exodus, that being a mass departure of people, for which this book is named. For the last 6 weeks of messages, Moses has been demanding that Pharaoh let the people go. Well, now, Pharaoh no longer has any choice. After 10 devastating plagues, Egypt is reduced to ruin. Their crops, their livestock, their property, their health, their source of water, and now even their children are destroyed. The calamity is so severe that it will take generations to recover, and though Egypt will remain a world power throughout the Old Testament, Egypt will never again be the undisputed superpower of the earth as she once was. For the last 2 weeks, we have been studying in Exodus chapters 12 and 13. We have already highlighted those verses which were most pertinent to the Passover and the plague of death, and now we turn to those verses which focus on the people of Israel actually leaving Egypt. If you want, you could just read the whole 2 chapters, but our focal verses today are chapter 12, verses 31 through 42, and verse 51, and chapter 13, verses 17 through 22. Those, again, are chapter 12, verses 31 through 42 and 51, and chapter 13, verses 17 through 22. As usual, I will invite you to read the passage for yourself. As we have read, Moses and Aaron have been pronouncing plagues on Egypt. Most recently, Moses warned Pharaoh that there would be a plague of death on the firstborn of Egypt. The people of Israel, however, have been protected from the death by the blood of a lamb smeared on their doorposts. Every house of the Egyptians has a dead person in it, and Pharaoh is no exception. And so, in the middle of the night, when the death comes, Pharaoh, in chapter 12, verses 31 through 32, demands that Moses and Aaron go. This is Pharaoh's unconditional surrender. In previous plagues, Pharaoh has attempted to bargain. He has said that the men could go, but not the women and children. He has said that all the people could go, but not the livestock. He said that he would allow everyone to go so long as they didn't go far and were coming right back. But now, Pharaoh is utterly defeated. The bargaining is over. He is finally prepared to give the Hebrews everything that Jehovah has demanded for them. He makes the point clear. He tells Moses and Aaron to go. He tells them to take their people with them and go. He tells them to take their livestock and go. He doesn't care how they go anymore, just so long as they go, and go quickly. Pharaoh concludes his command to Moses with an interesting request. He asks Moses and Aaron, "Bless me also." We might expect that the Hebrews would be eager to curse Pharaoh for his centuries of abuse and his pride, but Pharaoh is hard to hate in this moment. He has been so devastated that he is no longer any meaningful threat. It is clear that he cannot stand before the one true God, and as such, he is now reduced to begging for a blessing from God's people, even from a man whom he threatened to kill not even 2 chapters ago. The scriptures declare to us in Philippians chapter 2, verse 10, that every knee will ultimately bow to Jesus. Well, Jesus hasn't appeared in the flesh at this point, but here, even Pharaoh, who is the hardest-hearted and most powerful man in the world, is made to grovel and beg before Moses, Christ's representative. We have discussed that Christ's return will be ushered in by plagues reminiscent of those in Egypt, and I suspect that many of those tribulations will be what ultimately press every knee to bow, just as the plagues have pressed Pharaoh to beg. Pharaoh started out saying that he didn't know who Jehovah was. I think he's finally figured it out. Whether Moses gave a blessing to Pharaoh, we don't know. The scene cuts in verse 33 to the rest of the Hebrews and their Egyptian masters, and we find that the reaction of the Egyptians is little different to that of their ruler. This plague has been so severe that they are now insistent the people of Israel go before everyone in Egypt dies. They demand that the Israelites leave in such a hurry that the Israelites don't even have time to prepare food for the journey. They pack up their bowls and their dough on their shoulders and rush out in haste. They did not leave without taking advantage of the situation, however. They asked the Egyptians to give them silver, gold, jewelry, and clothing, all of which were very valuable and expensive at the time. And whatever they asked, the Egyptians gave to them. We can imagine that the Egyptians are so grief-stricken and shocked that the objects have lost all value to them. After losing a child or a spouse or a beloved sibling, surely nothing they owned seemed worth much compared to what they had lost. At the same time, nothing can be worth anything at all to a dead man, and the Egyptians maintain a very reasonable expectation that they'll die if the Hebrews don't leave. Better to pay them to get out of town than to wait around and die with a pile of silver. And so Israel escapes with the plunder in a hurry. In verse 37, we read that the people of Israel traveled from Ramesses to Succoth. It passes by for us in half of a verse, but this must have taken some time, particularly for such a large group of people on foot. We don't know with absolute certainty just where either the starting location or the destination were. Some posit that it is something like 20 miles to walk, and that Succoth was still in the general region of the Nile Delta. Others propose that this was a 200-mile journey along the western edge of the Sinai Peninsula. In the short case, it surely took all day to move all those people, particularly with children and livestock that far. And in the long case, we can reasonably expect that this journey took a week or more. And there was certainly a great number of people going. There were 600,000 men. Now this number, I think, needs a little bit of explaining. First, let's remember that this, like many biblical numbers, is a rough number. It doesn't imply that there was a head count and exactly 600,000 men walked out of Egypt. We find, though, that the number is consistent with the rest of Scripture, where there is a full count. In Numbers chapter 1 and 2, we read that a census was taken of all the men of Israel a few years after they left Egypt, and that there were 625,550 men, including Levites, at that time. That number fits quite nicely with what we have written here in Exodus. If the number of those participating in the Exodus is only rounded a little, we might suppose that there was some growth in the number of Hebrews in the years following the Exodus, and that's something we would expect if they continued to have children in the wilderness. Now, it might seem a little wild to you at first that there is such a large number of Hebrews. How exactly did 70 people turn into 600,000? Well, first off, verses 40 through 41 tell us that they had 430 years to the day to do it. And really, that isn't unreasonable. The Hebrew population would only have to grow at about 2.2% per year to reach that number. Today, the population growth of Earth is, according to Wikipedia, about 1.1%. 2.2% then is about double the population growth that we see in the world today. We should bear in mind, though, that the ancient Hebrews were polygamist, meaning that they took full advantage of their maximum reproductive capacity, and despite Pharaoh's short-term efforts to eliminate the Hebrews, they were generally not engaging in any form of birth control or abortion. We can also safely assume that they married younger and reproduced for more of their fertile years, and that they had more children per family than the average family does today. In modern times, of course, there is a concerted global effort to lower the human population through contraception, abortion, and putting women to work instead of putting them to childbearing, so it isn't unreasonable to think that the Hebrews could have doubled our rate of population growth with ease. So we have 600,000 men leaving Egypt. We suppose, of course, that each man had a wife, and maybe even more wives than one, and a man with a wife tends to have children, so I would suppose that the total number of people leaving Egypt was at least 1.2 million, and likely more than 2 or even 3 million people. To give you some sense of how big this crowd was, there were probably enough of them to completely cover more than 250 football fields, and they were, as I type, about as many people as the entire population of Chicago. And if that isn't enough, Verse 38 tells us that a mixed multitude of people also went with them. So the group was mostly Hebrews, but we can also guess that there were other slaves and people who wanted out of Egypt who decided they would be better off joining the people of God. So there were a lot of people. Not only were there a lot of people, but verses 38 through 39 remind us that they had some serious logistical challenges to deal with. They had livestock with them, and they hadn't even had time to prepare food. Some of you know that it can be a real nightmare bringing a toddler to the library without a snack, so you can imagine how difficult it must have been to move a few million people and their sheep without any lunch. But they did it. It happened just that way, and it happened, verse 51 tells us, on the very same day that the firstborn of Egypt died. Moving on to chapter 13, verses 17 through 22, we see that God was visibly leading the people of Israel as they left Egypt. Verses 21 and 22 tell us that a pillar of cloud, which I suppose must have looked like a tornado, led the people by day, and a pillar of fire led them by night. Obviously, they needed the pillar of fire at night because clouds are difficult to see in the dark. We should note that God will often appear as either clouds or fire or both in the Bible. We have mentioned before that God may have appeared to Adam and Eve in the wind of the storm, a possible variant translation of the cool of the day. We have also mentioned that the Psalms describe God as riding on the clouds. We saw that God appeared to Abraham as a smoking firepot and a flaming torch, both a cloud and a fire, when he made his covenant with Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. We will see the cloud resting on the tabernacle and Mount Sinai when God speaks to Moses, and a cloud will fill the temple when it is dedicated. Fire will be the method by which the sacrifices made in that temple will be delivered to God. Elijah will hear the voice of God after seeing fire and then a cloud rising on the horizon. Ezekiel will see a vision of God that features cloud and fire as imagery and uses the cloud in chapter 10 of his book to represent God's activity in the temple. Daniel said that the Son of Man, a reference to Jesus, would appear on the clouds, and Jesus applied that imagery to himself, saying in Matthew 24, and also to the Sanhedrin when he was put on trial, that he would someday come on the clouds. Revelation 14 also describes the Son of Man coming in this way. The cloud descended on Jesus at the Transfiguration, an important appearance of God the Father in his earthly ministry, and when Jesus ascended to heaven, a cloud took him up. So here's the point. When you see clouds and fire in the Bible, you should be asking yourself if this is a theophany. Theophany is just a fancy word for God visibly appearing to mankind, so fire and cloud in the Bible probably means that God is showing up in some visible way. I think that cloud and fire are interesting vehicles for God to use as imagery. For one thing, clouds and fire are opposites at an extreme end of the spectrum. Fire is as hot and dry as things get, and clouds are cold and wet. Often in Hebrew, we find that two extremes will be used to represent the whole. A passage in Hebrew might mention the oldest and the youngest as a way to say that something extends to everyone. It might mention people from Dan in the far north and Beersheba in the far south to describe all the people in between. Likewise, we might be led to believe that God's appearance in both cloud and fire represents his control over everything in nature, from hot and dry to cool and wet and everything in between. We also recognize that fire and cloud are things which are both helpful and detrimental to man. A cloud can bring rain to water your crops and to fill your cisterns, and a cloud can bring a storm to destroy you. A fire can keep you warm in the winter and cook your food, or it can burn down everything you have. In like manner, God can be either of those two things to you. He can be a rescuer who provides for your every need, or a destroyer who ruins you, and this depends largely on whether or not you are on his side. Ultimately, God will be either a cloud of healing to you or a flame of eternal death. In Revelation, we will read in the final chapters of God's own city coming down from the clouds for his people to live in and have eternal life. Meanwhile, those who lived in opposition to God will be thrown down into the fire to burn for eternal death. God, then, is a God who is fully capable of giving us either a blessing or a curse, and I urge you to follow after him and strive for the blessing. Cloud and fire are also fitting symbols because they are largely out of man's control. A man can't reach up to heaven and bring a cloud down. Even with today's technological advances, we can't control the weather. The clouds are firmly in God's hand. And we can do little more to control fire. We can start a fire and we can douse it with water, but a naturally occurring fire in the wilderness can burn thousands of acres before it is brought under control, and only then at a great risk of life and limb, and usually with the help of the rain. We should also note that this fire in particular is unique in that it is a pillar of fire coming down from the sky. And fire does reside in the sky, in the lightning, in the stars. But the sky, as we have noted, is out of man's control. I think the cloud and fire are also interesting as evidences that the Torah is a true account. Remember, a giant pillar of cloud and fire can't be hidden, and this pillar of cloud and fire will lead the Israelites for the duration of their wanderings in the wilderness. So everyone could see this pillar of cloud and fire at the very same time that Moses was writing about it. Can you imagine Moses writing that there had been a giant pillar of cloud and fire visible to everyone leading the people, if none of the people could see it? Don't you suppose that those people would reject what Moses had written as being false? The pillar of cloud and fire had been visible to the warriors of Joshua's generation before they entered the Promised Land, and they could all bear first-hand eyewitness account of it to their children. Do you suppose that those children, or their grandchildren, could possibly be fooled into believing that there had been a pillar of fire leading their parents around in the wilderness if there hadn't been? It seems ludicrous to even think of it. If someone walked up to you and told you that your grandfather had spent his entire life riding around town on a T-Rex with a saddle, you'd say, "That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I know my grandpa, and he's never said anything about that, and something that big in the middle of town would be noticed by everyone, and no one else has ever said anything about it, and aside from that, it's impossible, short of some kind of miracle, because the dinosaurs are dead." You would immediately reject the idea as a total absurdity. And yet, all the evidence we have shows us that the people of the generations immediately following this event knew about it and believed it, even though it's insane and absurd. It couldn't happen short of a miracle of God. But listen, ancient people may not have had the technological or scientific advances that we have today, but they weren't stupid. They were every bit as intelligent as we are, and they wouldn't fall for some made-up story about a magical fire cloud any more than you would. The simplest and most reasonable way to explain the broad acceptance of the Israelite record of the pillar of cloud and fire is to acknowledge that the story must be true. So we have our pillar of cloud and fire sent by God, and the pillar of cloud and fire is leading the people. The most obvious path that the people could have taken would have been to follow the road to the northeast out of Egypt and directly toward the Promised Land. God, however, decides against that because the people are not yet ready for war. The Hebrews would be marching directly into Philistine territory by going that way, and the Philistines were men of war. They would not take kindly to a million people suddenly marching into their land and would surely be able to devastate a ragtag band of people who suddenly walked out of Egypt with their babies and their women and their half-prepared lunches. Now, we suppose that God could have just won the battle for them, but that isn't God's purpose today. He has a plan for his people and for the Philistines as well, so a battle isn't in the ultimate best interest, even if he could win it for them. God would prefer to prepare his people with miraculous signs in the wilderness so that they can have the power and the faith to defend themselves in battle when the time is right. Better to teach a man to fish than to give a man a fish. So instead of leading the people north, God chooses to lead them south. Now there is some question about exactly where he is leading them. Some suppose that by this point they are already on the Sinai Peninsula, and that they are going south down around the bottom point of that triangle, that they will ultimately cross the sea into Arabia at the Gulf of Aqaba. Others suppose that they are passing south on the Egyptian side and will cross into the Sinai Peninsula by the Gulf of Suez. Either way, the point is this. The Israelites are going off-roading with at least 1 million people, and they're going in a direction where the only escape route is over water, so we've set up a problem that will be solved in a grand style next week. The people are now camping at a place called Etham, and, to note verse 19, they have the bones of Joseph, their forefather who asked to be buried in the land of Canaan, with them. So then, we are finally through chapter 13 of Exodus, and the titular event is underway. The plagues of Egypt are finished, and the Egyptians have sent the people of Israel out with all the plunder they can carry. The Israelites are being led by a pillar of cloud and fire, an interesting representation of God, and they have been led essentially into a dead end. Next week, Moses and the Hebrews cross the sea. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.